It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's go back to some news you may remember from several years ago. Back in 2011, two ethnic Chinese men were seen digging up seeds in a cornfield here in Iowa. And when approached, they sped away in a hired car. Well, at first, it started as a routine report of trespassing. Then it quickly grew into a long FBI investigation. An investigation that uncovered a plot by the Chinese agricultural company DBN to reverse engineer seed lines belonging to Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer. My guest this hour is journalist and Pulitzer Prize finalist Mara Vistendahl. She recounts this true story in her latest book, The Scientist and the Spy, a true story of China, the FBI, and industrial espionage. In a starred review, Booklist writes this about the book: not since Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest has a cornfield produced so much excitement. Vistendahl makes industrial espionage both understandable and riveting. And she joins me for the hour from the Twin Cities, Mara Vistendahl. Welcome to River to River.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I have to just say, you made my weekend. This was my weekend read, and it was so fun. Fascinating, all those things. We'll discover, we'll see how much time we have to discover about this book. But I'd like you to take us back, if you could, where the book starts, the incidents here in Iowa that put this on the FBI's radar. Could I ask you to read from the very first chapter, page one, that starts off with the heading 2011?
Sure. Fall 2011. Deputy Cass Bowman sped toward the farm, the bright morning sun glaring through the window of his patrol car. To the north was the town of Bondurant, Iowa, where newly built houses huddled together on treeless lots, churches dominated street corners, and the marquee outside Dino's storage read, "Avoid all negative talk." To the south was a Tetris puzzle of cornfields. God-fearing citizens on one side, vast fields on the other, and two-lane 70th Avenue running like a ruler between the two. A few miles east of town, Bowman steered the patrol car toward the corn. The fields were a few weeks from harvest, and the corn stretched over 7 feet tall. Central Iowa had blossomed into the lingering, pleasant days that make its winter hibernation bearable. Just a few minutes earlier, Bowman had been about to take a coffee break at the get-and-go when an alert came over the radio for an incident out by 96th Street. South of here, walking westbound, there is an Asian male wearing a suit walking through a farm field, the alert said. He was dropped off. Nature of incident. Suspicious.
Journalist Mara Vistendahl reading from her book, The Scientist and the Spy, the opening paragraph here. So now that you have our attention, this espionage story that starts in Iowa, what happens next? How does this find its way to the FBI?
Well, so the field where this man was found is a Monsanto contract field outside Bondurant, as I said, and his appearance there set off this massive FBI investigation. So the FBI hears about the incident a few weeks later, adds it to a file that they've already started. There was a second incident involving a pioneer field where two ethnic Asian males had been found a few months earlier. And so these two incidents were so similar that Special Agent Mark Benton at the FBI thought, you know, what's going on here? I might have a case. So he started looking into it.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's probably good to tell our listeners a little bit about why this is espionage, because only since the 90s have we had in this country the Economic Espionage Act, right?
That's right. Right. So in 1996, President Clinton signed into law the Economic Espionage Act. And that was really the first time that trade secrets theft became a federal crime. And In the past 10 years, there has been a big spike in cases involving China and IP theft, and particularly in the past year or two, under the Trump DOJ, there have been many, many investigations involving companies and individuals from China who are accused of stealing IP.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, though, it is a hybrid or hybrids, an inbred seed, a seed line. Give us a brief explanation of how hybrids are created and then patented.
Well, I worry that you have listeners who know a lot more about corn breeding than I do. Not typically the case, but in Iowa, it is very likely.
Oh, of course, I'm
sure. The situation. Yeah. So one of the men found in this field was Robert Mo. He was an engineer from Western China who lived in Florida, had a wife and kids there, and had found himself kind of out of a job, of trying to get an academic job, and ended up working for this Beijing agricultural company called DBN. And DBN had this scheme to reverse engineer hybrid corn seed that they stole from Monsanto and DuPont, Pioneer, as many Iowans know it. And they did that by trying to get both inbred parents of each of these hybrid seeds. Their plan was to get 100 top-notch hybrid seed lines. So that meant that they needed both parents for each of those seeds. And they did it using a number of different techniques. At one point, digging up corn from the fields, also buying seed and then planting it out. And when you plant the seed, there's a small amount of inbred seed that then shows up and you can harvest it. And even at one point, they sent seed back to China in microwave popcorn bags.
Right. This was discovered later on, but I don't know if it was Orville Redenbacher's or a different type of popcorn.
It was Orville Redenbacher. Yeah, and Popweaver. So I should say they tried to send the seed back to China, but the FBI was on their tail much of the time, and so it was intercepted.
Right. Talk a little bit more, because this Robert Mo, living in Florida, but makes in the course of years many trips to Iowa, many trips to cornfields. He has some accomplices here. He's the only, American. Is he naturalized American?
He did not get his U.S. citizenship. He could have, but made the choice because he's working for a Chinese company, traveling quite a bit. He never bothered to get it, but his wife and kids are U.S. citizens.
Right, and it's very important here that Robert Mo's sister Mo Yun is the wife of this big agricultural company's CEO, DBN's billionaire CEO. Right.
That's right. Right. So he had trained as a scientist. He has kind of the affect of a librarian and two PhDs. One of these people has his head in books all the time and failed to get an academic job with tenure after he finished his second PhD, and then ended up working for DBN. He got this job through nepotism. And at first it was a fairly legitimate job. It's a fairly large Chinese agricultural company that's involved in a lot of different efforts. So they source animal feed for Chinese farms. But then his job kind of veered into illegal activity, and his boss came up with this scheme to steal seed.
Right. So over the course of years, he's stealing seed, sometimes buying it from just seed companies here in Iowa. Over the course of years, and the FBI is sort of following this activity to gain evidence. Another key character here I'd like you to introduce is a farmer, a seed breeder, Kevin Montgomery. Tell us where he enters the picture and how.
Sure. So Debian's plan involved a number of different prongs. And at one point, Robert and his colleagues came up with the idea to buy farms in Iowa and Illinois and pose as farmers and then, you know, buy seed from seed stores and kind of have a cover that way. And they hired Kevin, who is an agronomist and a seed breeder himself, to kind of be the front of that operation. Now, Kevin had no knowledge of any illegal activity going on, but he pretty soon started to get questions about exactly what DBN was doing. You know, a lot of the things that he was being asked to do didn't make sense. He flew over to Beijing, met with the company CEO and visited their lab. And after that, he was kind of scratching his head, like, what's going on here? And then one day, a few months into his work for the company, the FBI shows up at his doorstep and turns him into a reluctant informant. And I should say, so reluctant because he's a pretty straight shooting scientist, as Robert Moore was himself once. You know, he's not somebody who's very comfortable being thrust into this role of deceiving other people, and suddenly he's an informant for the FBI.
Right. If you just joined us, let me remind you that I'm talking today with journalist Mara Vistendahl. Her latest book is called The Scientist and the Spy, a true story of China, the FBI, and industrial espionage. And it's actually a story that has its roots here in Iowa. It recounts a conspiracy not too long ago to steal trade secrets from the ag giants Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer. So we're learning about the characters here. Kevin Montgomery, Mara, has these dreams. He's a small-time seed breeder, but has this dream, like when the Chinese DBN shows interest, he's like, oh, wow, I could have one of my seed lines, you know, be used by China and become really rich and famous. That's not the plans they had for him. And as you just outlined, he figures out this is just very fishy and becomes eventually an informant for the FBI. Let's talk a little bit about Robert Moe and the factors that led up to Robert Moe's arrest. And actually, there was the dramatic arrest of his sister. Remember, she is the sister. She is the wife of DBN's CEO. But there's a dramatic arrest of her at Los Angeles International Airport, and then Robert is arrested. Take us up to that moment, if you would.
Sure. Yeah, and I should add about Kevin, the seed breeder from Illinois. I don't think it's so much that he wanted to be rich and famous, but you know, he'd spent years planting seeds by hand in his backyard plot. And I think he really just wanted to see one of those seed lines get into circulation. And he came on board at this point when Chinese agriculture was developing really quickly. And, you know, you have many people in China who are eating higher and higher up the food chain. So there's more demand. There's demand for better seed. Population still growing and so forth. So, you know, he had this kind of small scale ambition, but then got tied up with this elaborate plot. Robert Moe, but to go back to your question, you know, Robert Moe, in some ways, these two men are somewhat similar. He also took this job with DBN, kind of hoping to provide for his family and, you know, protect their nice suburban existence in Florida. And then again, became embroiled in this very elaborate scheme.
Mm-hmm. And is arrested by the FBI at what point? Arrested at his home. And his this is really heart-wrenching. His kids watch him be hauled away, right?
That's right. Right. So part of what interested me in this case, I was actually a reporter in China when I first read about it, and then moved back to the Midwest where I'm from, and was then able to kind of retrace the case step by step. Was that, you know, on the one hand, Robert's company, DBN, was going to great lengths to steal research from Pioneer and Monsanto. But the FBI's reaction was equally outsized. And so this investigation leading up to his arrest dragged on over 2 years. There were the airport busts, as you mentioned. They bugged Robert and his colleagues' rental cars. Mm-hmm. They flew surveillance planes overhead, you know, because the farm roads in Iowa and Illinois, you can see people coming from a mile away. And so it's pretty hard for an FBI agent to tail somebody effectively without getting noticed. So the FBI turned to they have a fleet of unmarked planes, which they tapped to circle overhead as Robert was driving across the Midwest. The FBI had invested immense resources in this as well. And those two sides came to confrontation on this moment in December 2013 when Robert Moat was arrested.
Mm-hmm. He's arrested, spends time incarcerated, is trying to defend himself, eventually arrives at a plea deal. I want to kind of fast forward here because there's so many other aspects to reflect on here. You visited Robert Moe, a reduced sentence because of his plea deal. You visited him in prison. I don't know, where is he now?
He has served his time and he is now in an immigration jail awaiting deportation. He's been there for a year. The facility is now on lockdown because of COVID-19, and I don't think there's no certainty when he'll be able to go back to China.
Right. If I remember right, a 5-year sentence in this plea deal.
3 years.
Three years. Would you spoke with him in prison? I know you were interested in how Robert saw himself by the end of this story.
Yeah. So, I mean, as a writer, I always get interested in people's transformations. And, you know, even though this is a nonfiction story, I tried to structure it like a thriller and also like a novel. And so, you know, you want to see people have a journey over the course of the book. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have a story where that happened. Robert had moved to the U.S. in the 1990s, very hopeful and idealistic, like many immigrants, you know, hoping to achieve the American dream. He told me, protested in the streets in 1989 when the Tiananmen Square protests happened, and, you know, came here very idealistic about American democracy. By the time I met him in federal prison, he was very jaded. He had, of course, been enmeshed in this elaborate scheme and wasn't an innocent character by any means. But I did get the sense that he had become this pawn in a global rivalry between the U.S. and China. His case is frequently mentioned by U.S. government officials, so not just in Iowa, but nationally. Mike Pompeo has talked about his speech. Ambassador Terry Branstad, the former governor of Iowa, has mentioned this case several times. So it became a pretty high profile case for, you know, just originally an incident involving corn seed.
Right. And in your book, I was interested because we had talk shows, guests about this, reported on this when it happened. We had, before Xi Jinping became China's top leader, he worked himself up through the ranks and made a couple of visits to Iowa. And on the last visit Xi Jinping made to Iowa, Robert Mo traveled here to Iowa to join that Chinese delegation, right?
That's right. Right. So the other thing that interested me about this case is, you know, having had this background, being a reporter in China, and then, you know, moving to the U.S., I started looking into it at this time when relations between the two countries were becoming much more fraught. And Iowa and China have this very unique relationship in some ways. My grandpa was a professor at Iowa State, and my grandmother was a professor at a small school in Iowa, and they actually moved to China in the 1990s as part of the sister state relationship. So I know that these ties go back a long time, and some of that tension was being dealt with even as this case played out. So, you know, you have these historically really strong ties. China, of course, has become a huge buyer of Iowa agricultural products, especially before the trade war. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as tensions arise between the two countries, those relationships are kind of coming into jeopardy. And right. So that visit of Xi Jinping to Des Moines in 2012, he showed up at the World Food Prize building and gave this big speech about cooperation and how important these ties are. And meanwhile, Robert Mo is sitting in the audience wearing a fake name tag. So he's wearing the name tag of another.
Oh, yeah, there's a great story behind that. And we have to go away for a minute. Mara Vistendahl, my guest, the journalist, her latest book, The Scientist and the Spy, it recounts a conspiracy to steal trade secrets from ag giants Monsanto and DuPont Pioneer. A lot of it takes place in Iowa. Mara herself lived in China for 8 years. We'll talk, hopefully have time to talk about that too, covering China's renaissance in science and technology as a correspondent in Shanghai for science. And we'll be back. Mara, stay put, and we'll be back to talk with Mara Vistendahl. The Scientist and the Spy is her book. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is journalist Mara Vistendahl. Her book is called The Scientist and the Spy, her latest book, A True Story of China, the FBI, and Industrial Espionage. A fascinating read. Reads like an espionage novel. Talks about a conspiracy to steal trade secrets from the ag giants, DuPont, Pioneer, and Monsanto. A lot of it takes place in Iowa. And Mara, let's talk a little bit about some of the reflections you make in this book. First of all, you write in this book about how combating economic espionage has become one of the FBI's top counterintelligence priorities. And that this really opens your eyes, this book, to how now active economic espionage investigations are happening in all 50 states, and the majority of them involve China, right? And this is a shift that's happened in the last decade or two.
That's right. So over the past 20 years, the FBI has shifted from being primarily a law enforcement organization to being also counterintelligence organizations. So that started with 9/11, with priorities like counterterrorism, but it's expanded to include things like economic espionage, like IP theft, And the argument there is that the economic security of the United States and of U.S. corporations is a national security issue. And that's not something that everybody agrees with. But FBI Director Christopher Wray recently said that there are over 1,000 active economic espionage investigations involving China.
Mm-hmm. You pointed out here how China's rise has meant a lot of great business, especially for Iowa. But you write this in your book. Let me quote from your book. Pretty much the only people who have not made money on China's rise are American wage workers and farmers, starting with the Iowans who grow inbred seed. Explain that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I wanted to kind of peel back the layers of what is prompting this focus on economic espionage. And, you know, the obvious answer is that there has been a real rise in IP theft as China develops and is trying to become a more prominent nation technologically. There has been a lot of funding for research, but also more theft. But then beneath that is the fact that many of these cases are brought on behalf of really large corporations. And when you look at agriculture, particularly talking to farmers across the Midwest, many people told me that, you know, they're proud of a company like Pioneer being originally from Iowa, but they're also being squeezed by the market share that these companies are amassing, and the fact that you've gone from dozens of seed companies a few decades ago to just four now. And so when you look at this industry and what is really impacting people, it is the fact that seed companies have amassed quite a bit of power over these past few decades. And so they say that they are losing out on income to Chinese companies who are stealing their trade secrets. And that is an issue. But on the other hand, you know, overall in the industry, what should the major priorities be? There are also many people who say that antitrust concerns are a big issue as well.
Right. And even at the same time, as this investigation is going on that you describe in the book, the Department of Justice, U.S. Department of Justice was pursuing at some points antitrust suits against, was it Monsanto or both Monsanto, DuPont Pioneer as well?
Monsanto, yes. Mm-hmm. It was involving their licensing of traits to other companies. And that inquiry was dropped, and I, you know, found it completely fascinating that that was happening concurrently with this investigation into the theft of Monsanto's IP. And in the end, the IP theft investigation ended up growing into just this massive effort, as I've described. And meanwhile, the antitrust investigation was dropped. Now, of course, Monsanto is owned by Bayer, and they've dropped the Monsanto name. And, you know, this company is no longer even American. So the Justice Department and the FBI spent untold amount of money going pursuing the theft of the IP of a company that then left our borders.
Right.
So
and the
Chinese company.
Right. The interesting perspective, I was just going to say in this book too, for someone who's not a farmer, didn't grow up, I grew up detasseling for Pioneer for sure, many years. From a farmer's perspective, farmers decades ago had, you know, dozens of seed companies to choose their seed lines from. And what has happened because of these mergers is what you point out, there's now only four or less of these seed companies with these seed lines to purchase.
Right. And that was happening. I saw that play out even over the course of my reporting, because, DuPont also merged with Dow, Monsanto is acquired by Bayer. And this is something that people like Kevin Montgomery, the the seed breeder in Illinois, who I mentioned, who played a major role in this case. He was originally working for the big seed companies and lost his job in corporate mergers. And so, you know, there are a lot of people who have been affected by this trend.
Right. My guest is Mara Vistendahl, The Scientist and the Spy, her new book. One aspect I want to make sure didn't get away from us before the hour does is the claims of racial profiling by the FBI, the FBI tracking ethnic Chinese scientists here in the U.S. as they went about their daily lives. Talk about the case that's made by some people that this is really ethnic profiling and how the FBI responds to that charge.
Sure. Well, so I should say that Robert Mueller, the man who's found in this Monsanto or near this Monsanto contract field that I describe at the beginning of the book, you know, he did the things that he was accused of doing, as far as I can tell. He admitted to them. He pleaded guilty. But and nonetheless, race and ethnicity did come up in his case. And more broadly, in telling the story of his case, I wanted to get at other cases that were playing out over the same time period, because there's just a huge spike in investigations involving China and Chinese scientists. And many of these people I interviewed in my work, because I used to work for the journal Science. And so I knew that there were concerns among people that they were being targeted unfairly. There have been cases where the FBI showed up at someone's doorstep at the crack of dawn to arrest them, and then the person turned out to be innocent. That's happened several times. And so there are concerns among Asian American advocacy organizations and among other civil rights groups and so forth that a legitimate threat has provoked overreaction. So the legitimate threat being IP theft from China, and that our response has veered into overreaction.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, you bring up a number of good examples where the FBI really just botched the cases brought under this Economic Espionage Act. I wanted to talk a little bit, Mara, about the writing process here. You've written a number of stories. You're a native, even though you're a native of the Midwest, of Minnesota. You lived in China for 8 years. What were the biggest challenges you had in researching this book?
You know, this is one of the first projects I started after moving back to the U.S. from China. And there certainly were challenges, but I have to say that by and large, compared to reporting in China, it was a relatively straightforward and fun story to do. Had a lot of visibility into the case because the investigation had dragged on so long, and there were once it went to court, dragged on for a number of years. And so there were just hundreds of court documents. I then took all the names and places I could from those documents and then went and visited them, retracing the steps of Robert Mo, Kevin Montgomery. And, you know, in China, reporters don't have access to good data. We're often local officials often prevent us from talking with people. And there are just so many barriers to doing good reporting there. We don't have visibility into the court system. We don't have the Freedom of Information Act. And so those are things I really came to appreciate after moving back to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about, you told us, you mentioned your background, your grandfather, a journalism professor at Iowa State University, your father, you mentioned in the book, an ag reporter at a small town newspaper in southern Minnesota. You moved to Shanghai in 2004 at the age of 24. As you mentioned, you worked as the Chinese bureau chief for the journal Science. What brought you to China? Why there with your journalism work?
Well, I'd studied Chinese in college, and as I mentioned, my grandparents from Iowa had gone there to teach English in the 1990s. The other side of my family also had ties to China. And, you know, so I was one of many Midwestern families mine was one of many Midwestern families who have these longstanding ties to the country. And so that's how I ended up there.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting aspects you bring out, just mention briefly here, the story of while living in China, how you came to have a Paleozoic fossil named after you. You actually do have a fossil named after you.
Yeah, don't ask me to pronounce the fossil name. When I worked for science, I spent much of my time trailing researchers into the field. And in that case, I went with a paleobotanist to an old coal mine. And because people had been digging for coal there, they'd unearthed a lot of old rocks and so forth and fossils. And so we kind of trekked around this barren landscape and on that journey, he discovered a new fossil and very generously named it after me. So, you know, because of those experiences, I knew that there is a lot of legitimate research happening in China. There is also a lot of fraud and a fair deal of a fair amount of shortcuts happening. But it's a complex story overall.
I'd like to take you back to an earlier work that you published in 2011, Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. This book was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, a Slate best book of 2011, also Discover Magazine best book of 2011. Tell us about what you investigated there and the points you wanted to bring out about China under its sort of gender policy.
Right. So that book also started with reporting in China and then turned into a much bigger project. So I set out to understand why it was that there were more and more boys being born even as the country developed. So you've had the one child policy for several decades, and that increases the pressure on parents to make sure that their one child is a boy. But at the time I looked into it, in many ways, Chinese cities were becoming quite modern, people's attitudes were changing, and yet the sex ratio at birth of the number of boys born for every 100 girls was increasing. And that was actually the case in other countries as well. So then I went to India, Taiwan, South Korea, Vietnam, Albania, and also Azerbaijan and Georgia. So all these countries are having the same issue of more boys born than girls. And I have to understand,
I'm just curious, when you live in those cultures and investigate them, China and the other countries you named, and you have such, I think you name in the book something like 160 boys for every 100 girls. This is a big disparity. How does that change the culture when you live in it? Do you notice that much?
Well, that figure, 160 boys per 100 girls, that was from one county in China. And so there are areas, or there were areas, I should say, at the time when I reported the book, where you just had many, many more boys. And now those boys are becoming men. And I was also interested in what the after effects of this shift would be. It is pretty grim. The effect is that many men can't find wives, and so they're buying women, sometimes going to Vietnam or poorer countries. And there's also been a spike in trafficking, so sex trafficking and also trafficking of brides. And you know, in the long run, it's not good for the population, mm-hmm. or for society.
Mara, we have 5 or so minutes left of this conversation. I wanted to get your reflections now. You've been back in the U.S. From China since, when did you return?
2015.
2015, So most of the time you've been back, President Trump has been in office, and we've had an interesting relationship with China, with the trade war, and now with a virus that our president likes to call the Chinese virus. What is your perspective with your unique background, having lived and worked and reported in from China for so long, and now to be back in the U.S. living through this part of history in our country or world history?
Well, I'm very worried about the state of U.S.-China relations. Trump is part of the problem from my perspective. I should add, though, that Xi Jinping has also led China into this unusually nationalistic and authoritarian phase. And hopefully it is a phase, but you have these trends happening in both countries. In some ways, they kind of mirror image of each other. And I find it very alarming because we, as we've seen since the outbreak of COVID-19, we can very quickly end up in a downward spiral. Right now, we are reliant on China for the export of personal protective equipment, so surgical masks, N95 masks, all of these supplies that our doctors and nurses will need to fight the outbreak. And that's not a relationship that we can break easily. We can bring some production back to the U.S., but we can't do that with all of the production. The demand is just too high. And so, I mean, we need to keep the relationship afloat as much as possible to get through this.
Mm-hmm. Expand on what you just said about the likeness between Xi Jinping, the leader of China, and Donald Trump. You see what major similarities in their leadership styles?
Both have this vision of being a strong leader that Xi Jinping has cultivated this cult of personality. I think Trump would like to do the same thing. And both have really tried to consolidate executive authority. Xi Jinping has gotten rid of these unofficial term limits that existed in China and, you know, would like to remain in power forever if he could. And I just find it very alarming. We've seen since the outbreak of COVID-19, a rise in xenophobia in both countries. With Trump calling it the Chinese virus and other people looking for someone to blame, there have been a rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans. And the same thing is actually happening in China, where foreigners are being kicked out of their apartments. There are a lot of reports of anti-foreign sentiment, not perhaps quite on the same scale that's happening here, but again, this kind of mirror image metaphor is coming back to me.
Right. Mara, we've run out of time. We have a minute left, but for you to tell us, we'd be interested in finding out what are you working on now? What can we look forward from you in the future?
I've written a number of stories on COVID-19 that will be coming out soon. And as a journalist, I am very interested in covering this moment. It's tragic. It's very unfortunate. I hope that I can add a bit of insight, having lived in China and covered science there. And so I'll just continue to cover what's happening now.
Mm-hmm. From the U.S., not going back to China.
Yeah. Well, from my house.
From here, yes, that's what we're doing right now.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you again, Mara Vistendahl, a journalist, to her latest book. It's a tremendous read, and you'll learn about seed lines and stealing intellectual property having to do with Iowa agriculture. The Scientist and the Spy is the book, a true story of China, the FBI, and industrial espionage. Mara, thank you so much.
Thank you. I think I really appreciate it.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.